Okay, so why talk about Venezuela and Bolivia? That's the first question. I sort of thought of a number of reasons. They're not exhaustive. About 6 million Venezuelan people, mostly workers, are members of the PSUV, the United Socialist Party of Venezuela. And I think that's about the biggest socialist party in the world. I couldn't think of a bigger one. And certainly in terms of its population, it's the biggest socialist party per capita of population that I can think of. So that's pretty massive. For the last 11 years in Venezuela, as many of you would know, they've had a president who uses extremely radical language and has at times favourably cited people like Rosa Luxemburg, Leon Trotsky. Chavez has said other things, but he's said some cool things as well. There have been important reforms passed in Venezuela which have bucked the trend of neoliberalism. For example, and I'll go into this in a little more detail, healthcare and education have been massively expanded under Chavez's presidency. In Bolivia, some neoliberal attacks have been beaten back, and historic steps have been undertaken to recognise the many indigenous peoples of that country. And both countries have seen enormous popular participation in politics. Both countries have been really at the vanguard of the anti-capitalist movement worldwide. You know, that's a massive point. And it's extremely political. In both countries, majorities of the working class population actively support socialism. Like, this isn't just sort of trade union struggle. This isn't just sort of, you know, protest movements. It's, you know, at a quite a high level of political consciousness. And that's important to see because they're exceptional in that regard. And so for those reasons, we've got a lot to learn from both Bolivia and Venezuela. So they were the good reasons to talk about Venezuela and Bolivia. There are bad reasons as well. According to statistics from 2010, the murder rate in Venezuela is higher than in Mexico, Colombia, and even Iraq. And the government itself acknowledges that corruption and crime are huge problems in Venezuela. In Bolivia, the poorest country in Latin America, since Morales has been in power, the living standards of the population have not massively improved. There's some debate over that, but, you know, by and large, accurate readings of the situation say that the living standard has not massively improved. In both countries, there is a serious and ongoing threat posed by imperialism and by the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class, and their middle-class supporters. And we've got to be clear on this. In both countries, the ruling class openly advocate for dictatorship. And that is a threat that has been temporarily averted, but is still hanging over the heads of both of those populations. And, you know, in both countries, they still retain enormous fortunes. You know, the actual wealth of most of the capitalist class in both countries has not been touched. It's not been expropriated. And, you know, the history, in particular, the history of Latin America demonstrates that coups d'etat and dictatorships are generally the fate of reforming governments. So that's still a big possibility. Finally, the other reason for doing this talk is that there is widespread confusion on the left. Many socialists around the world take the claims of Chavez or Morales at face value, and more still are confused about the class nature of those governments. For example, in Australia, the Revolutionary Socialist Party, a break-off from the Socialist Alliance, contend that it's a workers' and peasants' state in Venezuela. The Socialist Alliance is slightly more guarded, but their rhetoric still does emphasise that Venezuela is in a transition towards socialism. Others on the left, for example, a regular contributor to the Green Left Weekly, Federico Fuentes, has been an apologist for the Bolivian government, lining up with the government over effective wage cuts. So in this talk, I basically aim to discuss the recent history of the two countries, to explain how there came to be such apparently left-wing governments. I want to look at the limitations and the crises affecting both of those countries. I want to respond to some of the opinions that exist on the left about those two countries, and I want to suggest a revolutionary Marxist approach to those two countries. So to begin with Venezuela. Drink of water. Venezuela has historically been an extremely class-divided society. The rich made their wealth from oil. Venezuela has enormous oil reserves. And as such, they never much saw the point in investing in infrastructure, in social spending. They were quite happy to preside over enormous inequality and degradation. And, you know, the rich in Venezuela were truly sort of, an international class. Like, they were, you know, multiple properties around the world, you know, in France, in Florida, you know, huge mansions in Venezuela. Like, you know, a class that lived in sort of, you know, like world standard bourgeois luxury amidst poverty. The poor, on the other hand, and those that participate in the informal economy, the working class, you know, until very recently lived in extreme poverty. In the late 80s and 90s, this class hatred that was latent in the system came out, and particularly in response to neoliberal attacks. And there were uprisings that were centred around the barrios, you know, the sort of huge slums that surround, in particular, Caracas. Now, these were defeated, but at the end of these, Chavez came into politics. And he achieved national prominence with Operation Zamora, which in 1992 was an attempted coup. And unlike many coups that happened, this was a populist coup. And the over, you know, the population of Venezuela basically saw in Chavez's actions, you know, huge hope and inspiration. He became a hero. He stayed in prison for about 2 years after that, but afterwards he came out and, you know, was perceived as a popular hero. So in 1999, the presidential elections, Chavez swept into power with 56.2% of the vote. And that is massive. You know, it had been basically a two-party system in Venezuela until that point, with both parties sharing power. And, you know, the absolute bankruptcy of the political system in Venezuela was demonstrated by the fact that his leading opponent was a former beauty contestant winner. So, you know, go figure. He swept to power, you know, on this overwhelmingly popular vote. And this was against, like, you know, hysteria from the corporate media. And, like, you know, I'm not going to focus so much on this, but, like, so much of the opposition to Chavez has been, you know, far right. It's been extremely racist. And, you know, it's particularly in Venezuela, in the media of North America. But, you know, there's been a concerted campaign against him by the ruling classes of the world using their media. So what was Chavez's ideology at this point? It was not very coherent. It was eclectic. It was certainly populist. It was very nationalist. And in particular, Simon Bolivar, Bolivarianism, had a big role in Chavez's ideology. Bolivar was the, you know, the liberator of Latin America, but at the same time was a relatively authoritarian nationalist. So he figures in a large way in Chavez's ideology. And of course, there's a degree of socialist rhetoric to Chavez's ideology. You know, themes like poder popular, you know, popular power, have always featured in Chavez's rhetoric. So he was relatively confused, and his ideas have changed over time. But the people that surrounded him were largely former Stalinists, nationalists, or bureaucrats. So, you know, there was not some coherent political movement, particularly, or some, you know, movement inspired by revolutionary politics around him. Yet he has a massive appeal to the working class. And, you know, he's really one of the most popular world leaders. So within 2 months of coming to power, he organised a referendum to form a constituent assembly, which drafted a new constitution. Of 131 delegates to this constituent assembly, 125 were Chavistas. And the new constitution, made the Venezuelan system more democratic, and this was ratified by 71% of the population. And, you know, this is a point to include another aside. He's about the most democratic world leader that exists. A lot of the right-wing campaigning against Chavez go on about him being a dictator. This is a lie. The man has won more elections and more overwhelmingly than about any other world leader that exists. And, like, you know, popular participation has been an ongoing feature of his rule. So to say that the guy's a dictator is bizarre and insane. You know, like, seriously, it's nuts. And so as a result of these changes, a moderate reform process was begun. A cap was put on foreign involvement in the oil industry. Education spending was increased. The Ley de Tierras was passed, which allowed landless peasants to cultivate unused land. And, you know, this was more moderate than some of the reforms that came after 2002. But this was enough for the bourgeois opposition to shift into gear. There was an enormous media campaign that I've already mentioned. And effectively, there was a debate amongst the ruling class of Venezuela. About, there are basically two options, and John Pilger goes into this really well in the film War on Democracy, if anyone wants to watch it. The two options were a soft coup or a hard coup. You know, a soft coup would have been economic sabotage, and indeed this did happen. You know, like millions upon millions of dollars worth of investment left the country. You know, so a soft coup, you know, media pressure engineered to cause the government to collapse, or a hard coup, you know, sort of a Pinochet-style military takeover involving mass murder. You know, the ruling class openly debated these things. So much for liberal democracy. And, you know, they mobilised middle-class protesters. And, you know, sort of you got this sort of bizarre phenomena, you know, like obviously quite wealthy, quite white middle-class people protesting in the streets about Chavez the dictator. You know, that was a feature of you know, some of this ruling class campaign. On the 10th of April in 2002, the right-wing opposition in league with the CTV, which was a right-wing union in Venezuela, a union that was very much a boss's union, you know, whose leaders were extraordinarily unpopular. They launched a general strike. They staged violence. They actively planned for shootings to occur on one of the main demonstrations, and they planned this quite consciously as a pretext to launch a coup. And so using this as a pretext, they basically they seized the presidential palace, arrested Chavez, you know, flew him out of the capital. The constitution was declared to be suspended, the democratically elected government fired, and so on. This was a classical coup d'etat, a manufactured coup d'etat. The American government immediately recognized the new government. So, you know, again, yeah. Long live democracy. And, you know, this was, you know, seen as a good thing for imperialism. And of course, the United States has subsequently admitted to funding the opposition massively and effectively funding this coup. The coup, however, was foiled. And it was foiled by popular intervention on a massive and extremely determined scale. Basically, the night of the coup, masses upon masses of people from the barrios around Caracas fled into went into the capital and surrounded the presidential palace. And, you know, enormous scenes of mass protest and resistance and that. And this basically caused the coup to collapse. You know, sections of the army decided to defend the government. The presidential guard defended the Chavez government, and the coup collapsed within about a day. And Chavez came back to the country and, you know, resumed being president. This was a huge defeat for the ruling class of Venezuela. And this was part of what radicalized politics in Venezuela. Since then, there were the ruling class staged two other major attempts to disrupt Chavez's government. An oil strike was, you know, again, a strike, you know, organized by the pro-boss union. And this was undermined by, you know, decent trade unions and by massive community protests. And they organized a referendum using provisions in Chavez's own constitution. You know, there's a provision in his constitution that you can call a referendum for the recall of the president if you get enough signatures on a petition. So they used his own constitution to try and overthrow him. And, you know, Chavez won that referendum overwhelmingly. You know, it was a massive vote of approval in Chavez. And so pretty much since then, with some exceptions, the ruling class has said, okay, you win in terms of politics. You know, the ruling class has continued to make a killing in Venezuela, especially as oil prices rose in about 2004. But, you know, those events were all a pretty magnificent defeat for the ruling class, for the bourgeoisie in Venezuela. And so, as I mentioned, the 2000 coup and the subsequent failures of the ruling class did radicalize politics in Venezuela. The government introduced reforms, including subsidized food. They doubled education funding and effectively eradicated illiteracy. About 1.5 million people have been taught to read by the Venezuelan government. Misiones, a sort of local governments, but they exist parallel to the state. They've been established to provide social service in the barrios, which were previously pretty much ignored by the government. And Venezuela now has the highest minimum wage of any country in Latin America. So these are some of the achievements that have been won in Venezuela since 2002. And most importantly, the mass of people in Venezuela saw that they had saved their government. So that's key. That's part of understanding the radicalism of it and why Chavez continues to be an extremely popular leader in Venezuela. Chavez's rhetoric itself shifted as a result of this. Since 2002, he's talked much more about moving towards socialism, socialism of the 21st century. He's spoken of smashing the bourgeois state, and he's spoken of expanding popular power at great length. His anti-imperialist rhetoric has also intensified. You know, that awesome scene where, you know, after George Bush spoke at the UN, he got up and said, anyone smell sulfur? I think the devil's been here. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we'd agree with in that. But now to talk about the limitations of the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela. Thank you. I would say there are three problems, basically, overall, and I'll go into explaining a bit of each one. The first are the limitations of the reforms that have been introduced. The second is the ongoing problem of bureaucracy and the ongoing fight for direct democracy. And the third is the ongoing threat of intervention, imperialist intervention, or a coup. These are the three things that are facing Venezuela. So to look at the first, despite sharp reductions, there is still mass poverty in Venezuela alongside mass wealth. Like, you know, Caracas has still got to be one of the most class-divided cities in the world. You've got enormous shanty towns, you know, in which, like, millions of people live, you know, precariously. Whenever there's, you know, rains, thousands of people die in mudslides on account of how poorly these shanty towns are built. That alongside enormous mansions and opulence that have not been expropriated by the government that still exist in Caracas. Since the world economic crisis, prices in Venezuela have shot up, and the government subsidies on food have not been enough to maintain people's living standards. So the living standard in recent years has actually dropped in Venezuela as a result of the international capitalist economy. Many of the misiones that I mentioned have collapsed owing to a lack of revenue or because the government has pulled out revenue, and this is something I'll get into in a second. Some industries, particularly those related to oil production, have been nationalized. Yet a higher proportion of the French economy is nationalized than the Venezuelan economy. So a lot of the rhetoric about nationalization is overstated. Those corporations that were nationalized were paid compensation at market rates. And aside from one or two cooperatives that exist, the overwhelming majority of nationalized corporations were not nationalized under workers' control. Now, some of them incorporated workers' representation on management, and that is something that has existed a number of times throughout the history of capitalism. You know, I can think of three examples. It existed, you know, in Italy prior to World War I. It has existed in China on and off since, you know, for a long time now. It existed in Yugoslavia under Tito. You know, workers' representation on the board of management is quite different from workers' control over production. There's no widespread workers' control over production in Venezuela. And Chavez himself has guaranteed the ongoing role of private capital. His basic attitude is to support national capital. So he'll typically be more hostile towards international capital, but his argument to the ruling class of Venezuela, you know, the local capitalist class, is support the government, support the nation, and we'll support you. You know, in particular, he has protected the investments of countries with which he's allied. So, for example, there was a dispute in which workers in a factory owned by an Argentinian company were calling for nationalisation of workers' control. Chavez initially sided with them, but then sided with the company after discussions with the government of Argentina. Similarly, he protects the investments of countries like China and Iran. But, you know, broadly speaking, there's been no move to expropriate the rich or the ruling class. The top income tax bracket is still about 34%, which is lower than in Australia and about the same as in the United States. So that's a pretty big limitation. And as I mentioned, there's an extremely high crime rate in Venezuela. Now, it'd be unfair to blame that entirely on the government. I don't think that's appropriate. A lot of it's centered around corruption in the police force, and a lot of it's connected to the drug trade in Colombia. And of course, Colombia has seen, you know, has seen to it to try and sabotage what's happening in Venezuela every step of the way, because Colombia is the most powerful American outpost in North American outpost in Latin America. But still, there's an enormous crime rate in Venezuela. And this has all resulted in, you know, in problems, political problems. For example, in the National Assembly elections that happened in 2010, fewer people voted for the PSUV, Chavez's party, than are members of it. That party has about 6 million members, as I mentioned, fewer people than that voted for it in the elections. That indicates relative disengagement from the political process, which is a danger. And that said, there is historic skepticism of the National Assembly in Venezuela, and that's, you know, legitimate, but that's still a pretty big problem. Now, the second problem that I highlighted, that of bureaucracy and the ongoing fight for direct democracy. And I actually think this is probably one of the biggest problems or issues that faces Venezuela. Chavez inherited a bourgeois state, and this has been the biggest obstacle to change. It's actually something he more or less acknowledges. Corruption has eaten away millions of dollars. Food intended for the poor often disappears and gets sold on the private market. Infrastructure spending has been embezzled. Projects continually are delayed. Effectively, there is a bureaucracy that is quite intent on its own interests, that do not have the interests of the population at heart. This is not just right-wing propaganda. This is something that is acknowledged by the more left-wing people in the government themselves. That said, people like Chavez rely on this state. He's at the head of this state. And overwhelmingly, their attempts to deal with this bureaucracy have failed. In some states, governors and state police forces, which are formally tied with the PSUV, have actually been implicated in brutal repression of the landless populations who sought to take over land that's unused in accordance with laws passed by Chavez himself. So there are big divides, you know, within the sort of the formerly pro-Chavez camp. Some government bureaucrats have massively enriched themselves by buying, you know, bonds in the state oil industry and things like that, and then selling them on. And there's been an ongoing tension. Wherever there's been a little more workers' power or community power, and there have been some steps in that direction in Venezuela over the years, there's been a pull in the opposite direction by the bureaucracy to take that power away. For example, there was an important fight from 2002 onwards to set up the UNT as an alternative union federation to the corrupt CVT that I mentioned before. And, you know, like, Trotskyists were actually quite involved in setting up this independent union federation. And the, you know, parts of the government campaigned quite actively to try and bring this federation under government control. It was actually a struggle to get this federation to be independent. And at one time, Chavez, you know, argued in favour of this federation being under government control. So there's a struggle over workers' control and independence. And by and large, despite some attempts, very, very little popular power actually exists in Venezuela. You know, there have been some attempts over Chavez's reign. First, there were the Bolivarian circles, which were sort of activist groups that were set up and that were meant to assume more popular power. Then there were the Misiones that I mentioned. You know, all of those kinds of things have existed to some extent. His Socialist Party was one of the most recent attempts to involve the population more in popular power. But by and large, these have not resulted in effective workers' power or popular power over the economy. There are some sections of the bureaucracy that favour a more rightward turn. There's a section that favours the Cuban model and a, you know, a more authoritarian and sharp turn towards state capitalism and state control over the economy. There are others that rather want to increase the role of private capital and, you know, sort of aim for a mixed economy. So insofar as Chavez himself has supported popular power, it's really been more in rhetoric than in practice. He's attempted to do a number of things to circumvent those underneath him, but none of them so far have particularly worked. And as I mentioned, this all comes back to the key thing. He's at the head of a state that was crafted by the ruling class of Venezuela for the express purpose of ruling Venezuela for capitalism. So one of the key arguments in this talk that I'll get to at the end is that you can't transform that kind of state. You've got to smash it and set up a workers' state. Now, finally, the third thing that I mentioned is that the ruling class is not conclusively defeated, and nor is imperialism. The biggest armed force on the continent, the Army of Colombia, has threatened Venezuela repeatedly. There's the ongoing possibility of another coup, and, you know, that's an ongoing threat. But I suppose the basic point here is that all of this points towards the limitations of a more or less reformist project. It's quite an interesting reformist project in that it's done a number of things different from conventional reformism or historic reformism, but by and large it has not transcended that. And so without a socialist revolution, like a revolution that sets up workers' control in the economy, no government, no leader, no matter how well-intentioned, can overcome both the effects of international capitalism and the bourgeois state. So what's needed in Venezuela, in my view, is a workers' control over the economy. A workers' state in more than just name. There need to be rank-and-file committees set up in the army. There needs to be workers' councils established in industry. Industry needs to be nationalised under workers' control. Like centralised, you know, workers' committees need to be set up. Congresses of workers' committees need to be set up to provide a genuine alternative governmental structure to that which exists. That which exists needs to be smashed. It needs to be dismantled. That's the only way to avert the threat of sabotage posed by the bureaucracy. Now, key battles have been fought in Venezuela, as I mentioned, you know, and, you know, Trotskyists, for example, have been quite prominent in some of these battles. Probably the worst named Trotskyist in history, Stalin Perez Borges, is the national coordinator of the independent union that was set up. And, you know, within that union, there's a big tendency that is in favour of working class independence from the government. And that's important. That's really important. And I suppose more and more workers are beginning to realise that there needs to be an independent organisation for the working class. The PSUV, the party that was set up by Chavez, you know, it's massive, and its massiveness is almost its problem, in that it's well and truly controlled by some of the most right-wing people around Chavez and in the government and all that. Cool. Oh, I've got to speed up. Oh, and finally, there are some things that we need to be much more critical of Chavez on. You know, by and large, my attitude towards Chavez is sort of, you know, with him but further. But in recent years, there have been things that you need to be much more harsh at Chavez on. Foreign policy. praises Ahmadinejad. You know, he's been quite, forthright about his alliance with Iran, with China, with Libya. You know, Gaddafi, you know, people would probably know this because it's, you know, been talked about recently. But Gaddafi is a friend of Chavez. Gaddafi was given the Simón Bolívar Award and a replica of Simón Bolívar's sword. You know, Chavez talked about, you know, compared, like, Gaddafi to Bolívar. Said, you know, he was a fighter against imperialism. And recently, since the uprising in Libya, you know, Chavez has played a right-wing role. When the uprising was still in its early stages, you know, before it looked as though there'd be a stalemate between the two sides, Chavez was there saying, what we need is a peace agreement between the rebels and the government. So when it looked as though the government was about to fall in Libya, Chavez was intervening to say, we need a peace agreement. You know, we need to start negotiating. You know, this is not a revolutionary or internationalist foreign policy. And as I mentioned, at times he has opposed workers' struggle. So Chavez himself is certainly not the saint that a lot of people might make him out to be. Anyway, on to Bolivia. I'll try and speed it up a little. Bolivia is the poorest nation in Latin America, and it's extremely ethnically divided and has been since its creation. The highest areas, especially the city of El Alto, which is the highest capital city in the world, population's about 1 million, overwhelmingly indigenous, overwhelmingly part of the working class or part of the informal economy, you know, street vendors or people that do irregular jobs, those kinds of things. You know, these indigenous populations, there are multiple indigenous populations in Bolivia, have experienced genocide over the course of Bolivia's history. Many of them are peasants, coca farmers in particular, or involved in small-scale mining operations that, you know, extremely exploitative and all of that. You know, and the eastern provinces are overwhelmingly the wealthiest, the whitest, and that's incidentally where the most gas and hydrocarbon resources exist. Bolivia, like Venezuela, has produced enormous wealth for a minority. But at the same time, Bolivia has had a rich history of class struggle. In 1952, I'm not going to go into it much, but there was effectively a revolution which set up workers' council and dual power, and Trotskyists led, you know, mass Trotskyist organizations led large sections of the working class during that revolution. Between 2000 and 2005, there was what Jeffrey Weber, a socialist and expert on Bolivian history, said, called a cycle of revolution. In 1999, an extremely harsh neoliberal attempt to privatize water led to an enormous popular uprising in Cochabamba, and that brought that government down. And since then, two other neoliberal governments, which sought to implement similar kinds of privatization, especially around the hydrocarbon industry, were brought down by, at times, revolutionary struggles. And I mentioned El Alto. El Alto's interesting in that it's always been quite excluded from the political process, and therefore popular committees have an extraordinary amount of control in El Alto. And in those uprisings, you effectively had like control from below in El Alto, in other cities, and, you know, there were elements of dual power in those uprisings. This is known as the gas war. And in 2005, it led to the resignation of one of the neoliberal presidents that I mentioned, Carlos Mesa, and into this, Evo Morales, the leader of MAS, the Movement to Socialism. He stepped in. And I want to stress, he played quite a different role to what existed in Venezuela. So in some ways, you know, the two countries are quite different. The political situation is quite different. Popular struggle radicalized a leftist government in Venezuela, whereas in Bolivia, it was much more the case that reformism actively stepped in to take control of and redirect the revolutionary struggle. So it was a step forward to have an indigenous president in a country with such a history of racism, that's true. The worst neoliberal measures were averted, but hydrocarbons have not been properly nationalised. Morales basically nationalised the actual gas as opposed to any of the facilities needed to extract it. You know, and there are higher sort of taxes and things. The state takes a higher proportion of revenue from those gases than the previous governments did, but it's still nowhere near, you know, what socialists should call for. It's nowhere near total nationalisation. And Morales' government at the time was quite explicit that it was attempting not to create socialism, but Andean capitalism. Álvaro García Linera, the vice president of Bolivia under Morales, wrote, "There will not be a socialist revolution in a nation of small producers. We are not thinking about socialism for the time being." It's quite explicit. Morales himself has used more socialist rhetoric, but I think it's all been on the level of rhetoric. Real wages between 2005-2009 have only increased by 1.5%. And the massive popular demand for a revolutionary constituent assembly was not met. You know, the assembly that did meet was you know, very much stage managed and very much conservative. So there's been a shift in government rhetoric. There's been a new constitution passed. These are some steps forward, but overall, massive changes not occurred in the country. Guido Midma, the executive secretary of the Bolivian Miners Federation, said this: "No changes have occurred in the last 4 years. The promised revival of production has not happened. New jobs have not been created in the natural gas, mining, agriculture, or forestry industries. We cannot remain silent. The wage increase," he was referring to an increase last year which amounted to a cut, "the wage increase is miserable, even more so when the government is siding with the business community at a time when international mineral prices are on the rise. The government is forcing workers into exploitation and slavery." Thank you, Tessie. So Morales has changed rhetoric, but not the reality. He is massively popular, that's true, one of the most popular leaders in the history of that country, but there's a difference between public perception and what's actually going on. The FEJUVE, the Federation of Councils in El Alto that I mentioned, said this: "In spite of having an indigenous president like Evo Morales, the state is still governed by a Creole oligarchy. Although MAS has taken command with the support of the original indigenous people and popular classes, but keeping the system currently capitalist economic and neoliberal political system, nothing has changed for the impoverished people, still dominated politically, exploited economically by the capitalist system, and racially and culturally marginalised by the oligarchy." And this is a largely true criticism. And struggles have begun to break out against Morales. You know, that's a bit of a difference. In Venezuela, most of the struggles do not pose themselves as against Chavez. Even if they may come up against the logic of his project, it's much, you know, typically the people that criticize Chavez are on the right. The attitude of the left is to defend Chavez but to demand more. In Bolivia, struggles have emerged against the Morales government. last May, there were strikes amongst teachers, amongst manufacturing workers, amongst miners, all of which have been historically led by Trotskyists. The teachers still are. And they were over effective wage cuts. Morales first accused the strikers of sabotaging the national economy, and then when that didn't quite work, he accused them of being pawns for the United States. So, you know, some pretty gross things. Morales has not been willing to challenge foreign owners of Bolivian mines. His government has nationalized some, but it's a small fraction of the overall economy. And, you know, there's been compensation paid. They're not nationalized under workers' control, all of those things. The ongoing issue, there is an ongoing threat of a right-wing coup in Bolivia. In 2008, there were uprisings in the eastern part of the country that were supported by the military, by effectively fascist forces. Morales sent in the army and a popular uprising averted that threat, but still this ongoing threat is not being removed or taken away from the people of Bolivia. So the key to going forward in Bolivia is effectively for the working class. They're a minority of the country, but for the working class, they're a key minority, to form alliances with peasants, with indigenous peoples, with those involved in the informal economy in slums. It's effectively for the working class to form alliances with those sections of the population and to begin to lead a fight against the government. They may need to collaborate with parts of the Movement for Socialism, Morales' party, that is still part of that party but are willing to criticise. I'm not saying that the whole party is, you know, implicated in what the government is doing, but the reality is an independent working-class fight needs to emerge in Bolivia. Now, there have been a number of arguments from the left about Bolivia. One, for example, is that the peasants need to lead the process. This is, you know, a pretty historically ignorant argument, I think. Peasantry as a class have not been able to independently struggle in Bolivia. They've always come under the leadership of an urban class, at times the working class, at other times, you know, middle-class forces, for example, those arranged around Morales in MAS. Another argument that people on the left have used to sort of stifle criticism of Bolivia is that we oughtn't preach to the people of Bolivia, that we oughtn't put conditions on our support, and this is disingenuous. Now, no one on the left supports imperialist restoration in Bolivia. We're all for defending Bolivia against imperialism, but our solidarity should be not with the entirety of the Bolivian nation, but it should be with the workers and peasants of Bolivia. And to do that, you need to politically criticise the government. So anyway, I'd like to just sum up quickly, and I've already gone over time, so I apologise. There's a number of key points to draw out of all of this. First of all, I think we need to have a bit of perspective about these two countries. Despite everything, the reforms that have been won in Venezuela and in Bolivia are absolutely nothing compared to what was relatively common immediately after World War II. So a bit of historic perspective is necessary. Like the Attlee government in the UK introduced far more widespread social reforms than either government has done. The nationalist government of Nasser in Egypt introduced more reforms than either government has done. This is largely because international capitalism was more favourable to reforms in those times. You know, nationalist economic models were more successful internationally. So those that overstate the socialist nature of those two governments, you know, really need to take that into account. And this sort of demonstrates that there's less space for reformism and reforms internationally now than there has been historically. That said, it has been important that there are struggles in Bolivia and Venezuela that have gone against the trend of neoliberalism around the world. That's been important, and that's been a source of inspiration to people around the world. So, you know, that's another point that's important. That said, for those socialists around the world that consider either government moving towards socialism or embodying socialist ideas, I think that really demonstrates the poverty of those views of socialism. For socialist alternatives, socialism is much more about workers' control. It's much more radical, and it's a much more profound transformation than anything that's occurred in Venezuela or Bolivia. Were there genuine socialist revolutions in Venezuela and Bolivia, revolutions that smashed the state, they would undertake to do a number of things that have not been done. For example, industry would be nationalised wholesale with no compensation to the former owners, would be placed under workers' control. Foreign debt, private debt would be cancelled out of hand. The rich would be expropriated. Measures would be taken to prevent the rich intervening in the political process. The fact that Chavez has allowed the rich in Venezuela to continue to politically organise and to undermine the mass of the population is actually, that's the most undemocratic thing he's done, to be frank, is to allow the ruling class to continue to threaten the whole to the whole process. And finally, foreign policy would not be determined around forming alliances with foreign powers. Immediately after the Russian Revolution, the foreign policy of the revolutionary Russian government was far more about promoting revolution internationally. This, outside of rhetoric, has not been the aim or the practice of either the Chavez or Morales government. But that said, Latin America is a wonderful example of how things can be different in Venezuela and in Bolivia. It's a wonderful example about how millions of people, working class people, can be won to socialist ideas, can fight for socialist ideas, can at times risk their lives to defend their governments against right-wing coups. It's a wonderful argument about how militancy and class struggle can still win reforms, even despite the economic situation. A genuine socialist revolution in either one of those countries would invariably have huge effect across the entire region. And that's part of the inspiring nature of what's happened in Venezuela and Bolivia. And more, there are sections of the population in both of those countries, and large sections, we're talking tens of thousands here, who are starting to realise the need for this kind of transformation. So, you know, that's sort of where I want to end on, that, neither the government of Chavez nor Morales represent revolutionary socialism. You know, there are big limitations to both of them, but the popular struggles that have brought them to power, they represent what an alternative to capitalism is. And our argument is that they need to organise independently of the government, independently of government forces, and finish the process. They need to smash the state, and they need to set up a democratic workers' state in their place. Thank you.